This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Mike Tyson is ready to box anybody, including women and children. And could your next steak come from a cloned cow? Joining us today from the studios of Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we've got Kelly Crossley. She's a social cultural commentator on the television show Beat the Press in Boston. From our New York bureau, Walter Field, CEO and publisher of the NorthStarNetwork.com, along with Pedro Noguera, professor in the Steinhardt School of Education at NYU. Welcome to you all. And Walter, I want to start with you with a reaction to our A segment on whiteness. You were part of the original discussion of this study about white privilege. Did you learn anything new in Tony's conversation with the two academic experts?
Well, what it did, it brought me back to my childhood. I grew up in an ethnically mixed working class neighborhood in a suburban town. And we had Italians, German, Irish, Albanians, all my friends. And we all grew up together from elementary school through high school. But it was clear to me that by the time they were high school age, they had lost their ethnic focus and really became more white. And when I listened to discussion, I thought about the fact that I think some of this privilege is learned over time, because I think children don't necessarily see it, but I think you acquire that advantage as you move on through your life. So I think it was a very illuminating discussion, and I think it's something that we certainly should pay attention to.
Callie, there was a kind of quiz that Peggy McIntosh developed about signs of whether or not you are racially privileged. And one of the statements was, I can arrange to protect my children most of the time from people who might not like them. Another one was, I do not have to educate my children to be aware of systemic racism for their own daily physical protection. Can you quantify things like, you know, racial privilege, and how important is it?
I don't know if you can quantify to the folks that really are coming to understand what it means for them, or if they care to understand what unearned privilege really means. But I think what she's done in what's called the invisible knapsack is really point out in very specific ways how the privilege comes into your life every day. If you have a conversation with a number of, you know, very good thinking white people, they don't really, many of them, see this. And then you start listing some of these things and ask the question, is this something that happens to you? And suddenly, you know, the light comes on and they realize, oh, okay, well, yeah, this is happening to me. And I guess I am someone who benefits from this kind of unearned privilege. So I think what she did that was so revolutionary was to really break this down in very specific terms so people could see it and talk about it. And that's what's been absent from the conversation. You start having a conversation with somebody and you get into, but you've got this white privilege and they don't know what you're talking about. And back to what Walter said, I just wanted to underscore about that I think that white privilege has allowed folks from the lower class to bond with folks for the higher class and sort of be invited to the club, if you will. So that whole movement of losing the ethnicity and moving to become more white is something that's, you know, an extra added bonus for people who maybe thought of themselves as less than certain folks in a different kind of class.
Pedro, you could argue that that's what happened during the Civil War when wealthy white landowners appealed to people who were basically sharecroppers themselves but who were white to defend the race and defend, you know, their way of life, even though their ways of life couldn't have been more different. What are our challenges now, today, in the present tense, to deal with privilege and discrimination?
Well, I think that much of the backlash we're seeing today against immigration, for example, is also related to the threat that many whites perceive to the changing demographics. That is, it's not merely black folks who've moved in. Now you've got large numbers of Mexicans and other kinds of folks as well. And the white majority is very much threatened. So sometimes this operates on a psychological level that's almost unconscious and sometimes very out front and overt. And I think as we see more and more communities changing their makeup, schools and workplaces, we're going to see more and more of a backlash. The other side of it is that America is becoming more and more diverse, and there's a huge increase in the number of interracial marriages. I have a colleague who studies the personal columns in newspapers. One of the things he's noticed is that increasingly when people are looking for a mate, they no longer specify race. And sometimes they don't even specify gender. They just want a body. They just want a person. And so that's a very interesting phenomenon that people are increasingly, when they're looking for someone, less likely to specify what race they're looking for.
Pedro, I want to transition to a related topic for you. There's a new study out of Vanderbilt University that shows that legal immigrants who are lighter skinned and taller earned more. Each inch of height is worth about 1% in earnings and, you know, lighter skin. So it seems as if, you know, it's not just about white versus non-white. There's all these gradations. How does that play out in what we're seeing in America today?
Well, I mean, it's not surprising. We've known for a long time that that there are advantages to being lighter skinned, that there are advantages to being tall and better looking, that people who have physical characteristics that are, you know, are deemed attractive do better in the workplace and do better in other areas of life. So it's not surprising that even immigrants and even undocumented immigrants would also accrue those advantages. I think it's a reflection of the kind of premium this society places on white skin, light skin, and on beauty. And I think it's unfair in many ways because you have lots of very talented people who simply don't have those physical characteristics.
Callie, the same thing holds true, not in this study, but in other studies for weight. You know, I think the figure I heard was that if you lose 10 pounds, you're going to make an average of $12,000 more or something. So, I mean, how far have we really come?
Oh, we haven't come far at all. But I have to say that even with the weight studies being absolutely accurate, it's the skin color studies that always come back. They never seem to go away. I mean, this is a phenomenon that continues. Somebody's teaching this to somebody else because the same response is happening generation after generation. It's a new group of people, but it's still happening. I mean, we know the dirty little secret within the black community about skin color and who is perceived to be better and brighter and all of that if the skin color is also matches lighter and brighter. The whole scam about the videos and the women in the videos and who represents beauty. I mean, it really comes back to the skin color issue being the most visible way for people to discriminate. And I know that weight is a visible way as well, but there's something about this that is just so stubborn that won't go away. And obviously it's tied to our beginning conversation about whiteness and privilege and who we are and who has the advantage and all of that. But it's just kind of sad to see it manifest itself in now a new group of people coming into the country.
Walter, bouncing off of what Callie said, there's a great organization called Black College Wire that syndicates news stories by students at historically black colleges and universities, and they recently did a big article on colorism, as they called it, within the black community. And this one guy admits that even though he's dark-skinned, his parents told him never to bring home a dark-skinned girl. So, I mean, do we have to kind of heal ourselves first before we can expect better from anyone else?
Well, you know, the skin shade preference is real. You know, I went to a historically black college, and certainly I think it existed there and in many other places. And where I think I really came to understand the depths of this problem was during my tenure on MSNBC as a contributor. And I was always amazed that when you had black guests on the show or those of us who are regular contributors, you know, the makeup artists would basically ghost us out. We would be so pale on TV because it was this notion of that, you know, you look at tapes and you're like, that's not even anywhere near my skin color, the type of makeup they put on me. So I think there is just this, you know, unbelievable preference for lighter skin. And I think we see it in a number of ways, whether it's within our own community, within popular culture, within, you know, discrimination in the workplace. But it is the stubborn thing that will not go away.
Well, speaking of racial types, archetypes, stereotypes, we have a very special gentleman that we want to address next, and his name is Mike Tyson. He's launching Mike Tyson's World Tour, and he's shocked everyone by announcing that he might fight some questionable opponents. In an interview on CNN, he seemed very excited about the plan.
This first exhibition will be with a sparring partner, acquaintance of mine, Mr. Corey Sanders from Washington, D.C. And then after it, we're going to a more I won't say political, but from a spectrum of where boxers some into some of the personalities from radio, television, some lady professional boxers I'll spar with. It's just going to be marvelous. You got, man.
Now, you said you're going to be sparring against ladies?
No, you know, like some lady boxers, maybe some children, some personalities like Tom Joyner's going to be one of the boxers.
Ladies and children. You know, boxing is one of these sports where there's always been, you know, kind of a racial component to it. I think of Joe Louis and, you know, whether it's for better or ill. But I guess I should stop putting Mike Tyson in a box because he is a very unique individual. Walter, what are we to make of this?
I think what we should do is close the chapter on Mike Tyson and move on. I mean, there is absolutely no value that we can extract from even really paying attention to Mike Tyson anymore. He's a caricature of a caricature of a caricature. I mean, it's really shameful that he's being trotted out in this way. And I think the more we pay attention to it, the more we feed into it. So I would like to just close the book once and for all.
Yeah, but you know, Go ahead.
This is Callie. Let me just echo that and say, I am way over Mike Tyson, way, way over him. And I would like for all free-thinking people to be way over him. And I think, Farai, you've introduced this in a very high-toned way. And this is just gutter stuff. Just please. This is just please. This is just too much.
Well, I do think that there's something fascinating about this, though, because he was someone who, there have been some boxers who have been, you know, like Muhammad Ali, very political, or like Joe Louis, really made a hallmark in a racial sense. But Mike Tyson chose a different path. And so I think he's worth talking. I mean, kind of what went off the rails here, Pedro?
Well, he went off the rails about when he was a teenager. And the real story of Mike Tyson is of a juvenile delinquent who was abandoned and who was taken in through boxing, and whose life really just completely was distorted by the celebrity and about the fact that he never developed as a real person. I mean, for a man who served time for rape, who has a record of beating women and men, to now be in the ring fighting women.
And let's not forget eating people.
And threatening to eat children. I mean, and biting ears. This is it's a very tawdry affair. And I think that, you know, it's clear that the public has a fascination with Mike Tyson still. His matches do draw big crowds and big ratings. And so I wouldn't be surprised if there will be coverage of this tour that he's going to go on. But I think it speaks volumes to what's wrong with this country, that we would find someone like this entertaining. Because this is really a very sad reflection on us as a society.
All right. So I guess we're closing the box on Mike. speaking of boxes, opening, meat, milk. That's a bad transition. I admit that there. sometimes I'm struggling here.
The segues.
Yeah, the segues. Where you were going.
Yeah, no. I'm moving on from Mike Tyson, who ate ears, to what we eat. How about that for a segue? The Food and Drug Administration first hinted that it would consider allowing the sale of milk and meat from cloned animals. The agency is preparing to endorse marketing such products. Now, there's a saying that people have in the computer world, never buy the first generation of a computer. I will not be the first person to line up for a clone steak. Callie, what about you?
No, I won't be either. And, you know, I really think that I appreciate science, but this just has the ooh factor going on here. And I think it's going to take a minute, in all seriousness, for a lot of Americans to get past that. What I worry about is them sneaking this stuff in and not telling you. So I would hope that at least we would be told that which is cloned and that which is not, so we have choices. But I fear that probably because of economics and frankly, because they can control some nasty factors, bacterial kinds of factors that have proven to be problems, that we'll probably move to this whether we feel squeezy about it or not.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you talk about things like bacterial factors, though, genetic diversity among animals is something that has been getting less and less in terms of farm-raised animals. And if there's one disease that wipes out a certain strain, that could actually be a huge problem. I mean, how far have we thought this out, Walter?
Well, you know, not being a scientist, I don't know how far the scientists have thought it out, but I will tell you this, I think it's inevitable. I mean, the real challenge is whether consumers, you know, when they get that cow, whether or not they not believe that that cow is truly a cow, or if it's some, you know, monster variation of the cow. So I think part of it is going to be the regulation of this process. And that's my bigger concern, because I think, you know, if we really begin to think about the regulation of food in this country, we should all be a little bit scared, because I think we've been a bit lax, and one day that's going to come back to haunt us.
There's plenty of clones in this world already. If you think about identical twins, technically one is a clone of the other. But here we're talking about deliberately creating not only clones, but clones specifically to eat. Pedro, is there something twisted about this, or do you think this is just an evolution of how we feed ourselves?
I think it's risky business. And it's interesting. The Europeans have been much more reluctant to introduce cloned foods, both in the you know, the vegetable department as well as animal. And the Americans, because we have such a desire to mass produce you know, food for the market, I think more pressure is going to be on there to go with this. But I think the danger is that we don't know the science well. We don't know what impact this will have either on the overall food supply or on consumers of this meat. And I'm worried, as Walter just said, that it will be introduced. We already have cloned vegetables on the market now. We don't even know half the time. We don't even know if the food they label organic isn't truly organic. We've got this E. coli bacteria spreading. I think we're in real danger of having the whole food supply jeopardized with this kind of experimentation.
Callie, do you think that the real question here should not be cloned versus not cloned, but labeling, as we've brought up?
Absolutely, because people definitely want to have choices. I mean, here in Massachusetts, there's a local milk dairy company, and they're making a big deal out of ads by saying, we don't have artificial growth hormone in our milk. And so, hey, consumer, if you want a choice, you know that we don't have it. I mean, I think consumers would like to know. And there will be people who won't be bothered by this at all. But I'd like to know, and what I fear is that it won't be clearly enough articulated so that I can make an informed choice.
And again, Pedro, you know, what could consumers do you think, to actually push for some kind of a labeling?
I think we have to write to Congress. We have to let it be known through the media that we have concerns about this kinds of experimenting with the food supply, and that labeling is, I think, the bare minimum requirement that we should expect, that we know exactly what it is we are is being sold and to us. But it's interesting. Whenever you travel and you try the fruits and vegetables, you notice there's a striking difference in the quality of fruits and vegetables, and that's because the food supply, we have such a narrow selection of fruits and vegetables already on our market because of this mass production. And the same is true in the meat supply already, because we have factory-produced animals now. And so I'm very concerned about the direction we're going in.
Pedro Nogueira of New York University, Walter Fields of the NorthStarNetwork.com, and Callie Crossley of the television show Beat the Press in Boston. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Ferrari.